Thank you all very much for coming. So this is very new research for me. I am an agroecologist, and I have worked predominantly in subsistence maize in East Africa before this, and I recently joined the faculty at the University of Maryland, and so I'm starting to turn some of my agroecological interests towards the Chesapeake Bay. And so this is a really fun topic for me because it sort of combines these larger scale environmental changes and looks at how those are interacting with small scale management decisions that farmers have been making, are making now and have been making for the last 100 years or so. And so I'll be focusing on the Chesapeake Bay, which is, I'm a Mac user, so some of these might come up a little slowly. So the Chesapeake Bay is the largest estuary in the United States. It's about 200 miles long and is relatively shallow. So there's the mean depth is about 21 feet. And it receives about half of its water from the Atlantic Ocean, and the rest of it drains from this large watershed that spans from New York all the way to the shores of Virginia and Maryland. Oh, good, that popped up this time. So the two research sites that I'll be talking about today are in the Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge, which is a more freshwater system, and then the Lower Eastern Shore, which is a more, which has a higher salinity. So the Chesapeake Bay provides lots of ecosystem services. It's home to about 17 million people. It produces about 500 million pounds of fish and various seafood annually, and it's over 300,000 acres of tidal marshes provide critical habitat for birds and fish and, of course, crabs. It also has a unique physiography in terms of the different soil characterization. So we have the Atlantic Coastal Plain, the Piedmont Plateau, and then the Appalachian Province. And so the coastal plain, where this research is primarily located, it has sort of an outsized effect on the biogeochemistry of the Chesapeake Bay because of its proximity. It has more, it has high infiltration rates, it's a very sandy soil, and the rainfall is fairly well distributed and has some surficial ground aquifers. It's also 32% of the land area is in cropland, and 21% of that land are in tidal marshes. So this is a really nice coming after this, the previous talk. So sea level rises in the Chesapeake Bay are double the global average. So you have a little context now. How do I pronounce your first name?
Donnie.
It's Donnie. Okay, because it's not different from what was on the slide. So Donnie was saying that the sea level rises around 4 millimeters per year in this region. Here, it's about 4 to 10 millimeters per year, depending on the different study. In the last 10 years or so, the recorded rates have been around 10 millimeters per year in some regions. So very, very quick. So sea level rise, this should say marsh accretion. Sea level rise is definitely outpacing the marsh accretion rates. And so the sink, swimmer, get out of the way applies here in the exact same way. These marshes gotta move. So where are they moving? Well, they're moving predominantly into forested land and into agricultural land, and I'll be talking about the biogeochemical effects of that in just a moment. But just to give you just a quick sort of forecasting or foreshadowing, what's the first thing that farmers do when we start to, you know, want to create a crop? We plane the land, right? So marshes can only move, if they move slower upslope than they do on flat land. And so what's happening is as these marshes and the salt water starts to move upland, they're hitting a farm, and instead of that rate being 2 meters per year, it's like whoosh, the whole field gets inundated. And I'll show you what that looks like. So as we know, tidal marshes are very important for nutrient losses, and as we lose marshes, we're losing the capacity to retain and recycle nutrients in these systems, particularly nitrogen and phosphorus. So a lot of great work has been done in this area, but we've primarily focused on what happens with these forested ecosystems as marshes move upslope. So this figure from Smith et al. Shows we have this forest edge that was here in the 1930s. With aerial photography, it's very easy to see now where the forest line, how far that forest has moved inland. And what you'll notice is about half that distance is from salt marshes, and the other half is Phragmites australis, which is an invasive reed. So we like to sort of think of these forests as being sort of caught between a reed and a wet place. Like there's not a lot, they're not just being pushed out by the salt water, but they're also being invaded by these by this invasive reed species. Good, the animation showed up. So this just sort of shows you what this looks like. So daily tides will move into these forested systems, and then as sea level rises, the salt water starts to move further and further into these systems, creating the formation of what are called ghost forests. And here's some data just to show the extent of this cumulative gain and loss of sea level rise and how that's affecting these marsh ecosystems. So this is done by Shepherd et al. Using the SLAM model, and these yellow areas are regions of persistent and high transitional marshlands. This is more or less present day. Here it looks more or less the same, but you're starting to see these cumulative gain or move, these marshes are starting to move inland with, especially in these tidal creeks, which is going to be important when I show you where we have our farmland. By the 2050, you start to see more of these gray areas, which is the loss of these marshlands. And so I mentioned that these systems, these forested systems, are not the only ones that are being caught between this reed and wet place. So this point right here is one of the farms that we've identified as sort of a test bed for some of these, for some of our experiments, and you'll notice it's right along one of these tidal creeks. So farmers are in this really sticky situation. You can see that there's not a lot of space for the farmer to go either. If they want to continue to crop these lands and grow, which is the typical rotation here, is a corn, soy, wheat rotation. So a lot of farmers are getting out, and they're getting out by selling their land or leasing their land and becoming what's called zero-acre farms. So I'm not sure if this looks familiar to any of you, but if you ask the question, what's upslope, it's starting to be, this whole area is starting to expand into a very predominantly poultry farming industry. So I'm sure you've got a lot of Delmarva poultry facts under your belt as well. So the Delmarva chicken industry produces about 600 million chickens per year. That's about 4 billion pounds of meat. And each chicken house has somewhere between 20 and 50,000 chickens. And Somerset County, which is one of the regions, okay, and that's just like at one time. So these chickens only live for about 6 weeks, and then they clear them out, and then they clean out the coop, and they clean out the poop that's in the coop, and then they put more chickens in. So in Somerset County, this is a billion-dollar industry. That's a small county and a lot of money, and it's the number one poultry producer in Maryland. And so we're starting to have a really sticky situation on our hands. So as these tidal marshes are moving inland, they're moving still into these forested ecosystems. This is primarily what we're seeing in the black water, and they're moving into farms. So this is the test farm. This looks like a beach, but it's salt water that's invaded this soy farm. And I'll show you what some of the salinity levels look like in a moment. And so we know that agriculture plays a huge role in the biogeochemistry of the Chesapeake Bay. About 38% of the nitrogen import or exports to the bay come from ag. 40 to 50% of the phosphorus comes from ag, and 26% of that comes from chickens, chicken manure primarily. So this is a big uh-oh situation. So this farm that I'm standing on was recently fertilized with chicken manure, chicken litter, poultry litter. And I don't know if you can see what this is, but these are chicken skulls and chicken bones. And then this was so it had a really rainy year. That's why I'm making that face. We went actually at the perfect time. I mean, you know, if you want to see what this looks like in the field, they fertilized and then it poured. And we were out there the next day, and we saw, like, chicken bones and all this stuff just floating all over this field. So, as we know, phosphate tends to accumulate in soils and moves with sediments, whereas nitrogen tends to move down, so phosphorus tends to move across, and nitrogen moves down. And salt water can mobilize particulate-bound phosphorus. So ion exchange, and then through the generation of iron sulfides, when we have sulfate intrusion, we have a problem on our hands, which is that poultry or phosphorus-rich poultry manure may basically be priming the soil for phosphorus release. So my group is calling this the phosphorus fire hose effect, which is, so this is just a typical figure that shows sort of phosphorus chemistry in wetlands. We have the water air, the sort of the water table line here. We have aerobic soil and anaerobic soil. And typically, we've got all this iron 2 and iron 3 that's binding the phosphate as it starts to move down into the anaerobic soil. So this is fine, except as we start to increase salinity and as we start to increase the sulfate concentrations, we start to see some competition, basically, for that iron. So hydrogen sulfide comes in and starts to form solid forms of iron, which means there's just not as much iron left to bind this phosphorus, which is leading to some diffusion of that phosphate into the water column itself and our phosphorus fire hose starting to move into these tidal marshes. So this is our theory. there's a case for the ammonium fire hose. This is some data from abandoned ag fields in North Carolina. So if you see some saltwater intrusion, when they were looking for saltwater intrusion, they found this increase of ammonium release. I'm not sure how familiar. This is incredibly high. Incredibly high, right? We usually are down here somewhere in, like, maybe you have 1, 2, 3 milligrams of ammonium. They see in these old ag fields, they're seeing concentrations of ammonium that are off the charts, right? So this is a huge concern, and they estimate somewhere around 18,000 megagrams of nitrogen could be released that's sort of hanging out in those soils should this sea level rise and the saltwater intrusion continue. And then the other thing I want to draw your attention to is that there's a difference between what we study in the lab and what we see on farms or what we see in the field. So here we have what was observed in the field, and this is what was done in the microcosm. And almost all of our data are from microcosm studies. We have very, very little information about what's happening on farms, like in reality. So these are some data from a microcosm study that do show that there is a case that this phosphate or phosphorus fire hose could actually be happening at salinity levels between 3 to 5. So keep that, store that number in your head for a second, because I'll show you what our salinity levels are on farms in just a moment. They're starting to see a big pulse of phosphate in the water column. And of course, this is going to be pH dependent, this is going to be oxygen dependent, it's also going to be time dependent, how long this could be a really ephemeral effect, there could be a long-term effect, but as I mentioned, most of the studies that we have are in microcosms. We don't have a lot of studies on farms, and that's because it's really hard to get farmers who are highly regulated for phosphorus to cooperate with scientists. So one thing I learned is don't say climate change, it's saltwater flooding. That's what's happening, right? So we have to use the right terminology. And then this, unfortunately, so we met with a bunch of farmers and they seemed to be very interested, and I was there last week or the week before, and all of our lysimeters were pulled out of the ground and broken up, and no, we couldn't find them. So they are interested, but there's still a lot of room for conversations about how we're going to actually make this happen, and I'll talk about that in just a second. So we did conduct this pilot study. All of the lysimeters that we installed in the Blackwater Wildlife Refuge are still there. This is an abandoned ag field. It's about they're about 8 to 20 years old. We have a young field and an older field, and then on the Eastern Shore, which is this area in Raccoon Point. And so here is our lovely salinity gradient as we move from the tidal creek. So we have sites at each of these. We're calling this is the marsh, this is the forest marsh, this is our forest, I called it bad farm. All of our samples say bad farm, and this is the good farm. But you'll notice that's a pretty high salinity to be growing soybeans in, right? And this is happening all over the county. This is just one example. And so thinking about those, that ammonium, where that pulse was, we saw that big pulse. So we also, I'm just going to show you a little bit of data because, again, this is very preliminary. So our concentrations are, we did not see 50 milligrams of of ammonium nitrogen per liter, but we do see these pulses in these forested ecosystems, and for sure it's the dominant form of nitrogen is ammonium in these systems. These are some of the data from the soil solution phosphorus before our poor little lysimeters were pulled out of the ground, and you'll see that we do have the highest phosphate concentrations in solution on these farms. And then that is also represented in the soil phosphorus. So those are all the data we have. This is very, very new research, primarily because it's been very hard to get farmer cooperation. Any of you who are familiar with the phosphorus management tool know that farmers do not want to talk to you about how much phosphorus they're applying on their farms. But we do have some really good leads with the Maryland Department of Agriculture. And so we're doing some macrocosm studies on some CREP land, so land that is in conservation programs. And we've had some really great farmers who have been willing to let us install some PVC tubes to look at this. We are going to do some field studies looking at salinity levels around these tidal creeks. We also are partnering with SYSINC, which is the National Socio-Environment Synthesis Center in Annapolis, and we're using their their data synthesis tools to look at historical phosphorus data and then GIS data on the tidal marsh migration. And so if any of you are interested, we've got some funding to do an Eastern Shore Research Network to really try to tackle this problem. And what we're doing, actually, it's kind of cool that we're at this large meeting. We have entomologists, we've got all sorts of folks who have good relationships with farmers and have been studying various other kinds of ecology on the Eastern Shore but have not gotten into the biogeochemistry. And we're starting to bring everybody together who works not on research plots like on ARS land, but actually with farmers and who have farmer partners to try to see if we can tackle this issue. So if you're interested in that, please come and see me afterwards during the discussion. This is as I said, it's a very new project, but I've got a lot of great collaborators, and this research, all this pilot data was funded through SYSINC and through an ADVANCE grant, which is for advancing women in science from the National Science Foundation.
Big question.
Turned on me doing this research, but it's really critical work.